Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hello, this is the BBC World Service. I'm Harriet Gilbert. Following the death this week of one of the world's most important and innovative authors, the German Nobel laureate Günter Grass, here's a chance to hear again a World Book Club programme I recorded with him in the summer of 2009. Günter Grass was a controversial writer. His political views on a range of subjects, from World War II to the 1990 reunification of Germany, provoked often furious debate and made him quite a few enemies. But to World Book Club, he was nothing but hospitable, inviting us to his house in the country, a short drive along winding roads from the German port city of Lübeck. So there we went, armed with questions from BBC listeners around the world about his novel The Tin Drum, whose 50th anniversary it was. The book, which has sold in its millions, is an account of the rise and fall of Nazism as seen through the sharp, furious, not entirely reliable eyes of a dwarf called Oscar Mazzerat. And to discuss it, we made our way to Günter Grass's writing room, a cabin slightly separate from the rest of the house, lined with bookshelves and with large windows through which could be seen a mass of leafy trees. As Günter Grass struck yet another match to keep his pipe from going out, I thanked him very much for inviting us.
Nice to have you here.
Thank you very much. Well, usually on the programme, it's not just me. You have an audience with you and an audience around the world listening. Today, we've only got the vast audience around the world. But they are here in form because they've sent in lots and lots of emails with questions for you about The Tin Drum. But before we look at the book in detail, there's one reader called Emily Lebetsis, who is a Greek-Australian who lives in Berlin. And she would like to know a bit more about the relationship between where you live now, near Lübeck, and Danzig, where you grew up and where the Tin Drum is set. I mean, both these very ancient cities were part of this Hanseatic League, this conglomeration of trading cities that for centuries pretty well did their own thing. They were a law unto themselves. And Emily Lebetsis asks, "Dear Günter Grass, how do you feel about Danzig nowadays after all these years? I take it it's not an accident that you now live in Lübeck, another city of the Hansa."
I change very often my places, and I hope this will be the last one. I'm here now since more than 20 years near Lübeck. And Lübeck has the same character, like all these Baltic Sea cities. Danzig, too, belonged to the Hansa, and this is a special brick, red brick style, yes, of cathedrals, and Danzig belonged for a long time to this dépendance, and this is one of the reasons I'm here, and I like the landscape, because this landscape with hills and lakes and forests, and it seems to me like the background of Danzig, the Kashubian area behind the city of Danzig was the same, nearly the same landscape. And my Danzig from my youth time, that's Gdansk after the war. And
yes, it's now a Polish
and
city.
It was destroyed. It was terribly destroyed by Marshal Harris and others.
The British aviator, yes, I'm very sorry.
About 80% of the old city was finished. And I think it is remarkable and admirable how in these poor times, yes, after the war, they did go on and rebuild this old city, my own city. That's now Gdansk.
Well, Gdansk, or the Free City of Danzig, are the setting for several of Grass's novels, including his first and probably best known, The Tin Drum. Published in 1959, over the decades it sold 10 million copies in 50 languages, and its half-century is being marked around the world by a slew of new translations, including an English one by Brion Mitchell. The Tin Drum's also been made into an Oscar-winning film, and it was certainly in the mind of the Swedish Academy when, in 1999, it awarded Grass the Nobel Prize in Literature and described his works as, I quote, "frolicsome black fables that portray the forgotten face of history." The novel's narrated by Oscar Mazzarat, whom we meet in the mid-1950s when he's a 30-something mental patient. Occasionally beating on the little tin drum he's allowed to keep with him in his cell, in bits and pieces Oscar tells his life story, including, crucially, his refusal at the age of 3 to grow any taller, his obsession with drumming, and his discovery when thwarted that his screams can shatter glass. Oscar's family is no more straightforward than he is, not least because his mother has an ongoing affair with her cousin, who may or may not be Oscar's real father. But darker shadows soon fall across the novel. The Nazi Party is gaining power, and although Oscar, who defies time by remaining permanently 3 foot tall, has no interest in politics, politics is on to him. Oscar witnesses Kristallnacht, the murderous rampage against Jewish Germans that effectively launched the Holocaust. He's there for what are arguably the first shots fired in World War II when the Germans attacked Danzig's Polish post office. He's there when the war drags to its end and Russian forces arrive in the city. But let's go back a bit to chapter 3 of Günter Grass's The Tin Drum and Oscar's account of his own birth.
I first saw the light of this world in the form of 2 60-watt bulbs. As a result, the biblical text, "Let there be light, and there was light," still strikes me today as the perfect slogan for Osram light bulbs. With the exception of the obligatory perineal tear, my birth went smoothly. Effortlessly, I freed myself from the head-first position favoured by mothers, embryos, and midwives alike. Let me say at once, I was one of those clairaudient infants whose mental development is complete at birth and thereafter simply confirmed. As impervious to influence as I had been as an embryo, listening only to myself, gazing at my own reflection in the amniotic fluid, so closely and critically did I now eavesdrop upon my parents' first spontaneous remarks beneath the light bulbs. My ear was wide awake. Although it could be described as small, bent, gummed up, and, of course, dainty, it nonetheless caught and preserved each of those watchwords that, offered as my first impressions, were henceforth so important to me. Still more, what my ear took in, my tiniest of brains immediately evaluated, and I decided, after devoting sufficient thought to all I had heard, to do certain things, and most certainly not to do others. "It's a boy!" this Herr Mazzarat said, who presumed he was my father. "He'll take over the business some day. At last we know why we've been working our fingers to the bone." Mama was thinking less about the business and more about equipping her son. Well, I knew it would be a boy, even if I sometimes said it would be a little lass. Thus, prematurely acquainted with feminine logic, I heard the following. "When Oscar is 3 years old, we'll give him a tin drum."
The birth of Oscar from the new English translation of Günter Grass's The Tin Drum. Günter Grass, we have a question for you now, which was sent in by a listener to the BBC World Book Club called Steve Oga. He's in Nigeria, and he writes this. "Hello, Günter Grass. It's quite an honour and a rare privilege to put a question to you. I would like to know just why you elected to make Oscar, your protagonist, a dwarf. That really intrigues me because I suspect Germany is by no means a land of short people."
No, this took me a long time to find the perspective to tell this long, long story. And I needed a person who was not involved, like a boy, but inside like a grown-up person to understand everything. He discovers everything from this special perspective from the table.
Yes, he is always under the table, isn't he, watching what's going on?
From under the table and beside the table. And for this, it seems to me very good to have a person like Oscar, also because this behavior of people in Germany in this time was the time that people who were not really grown up. There's like this childish reaction, this believing in everything. And this was for me, Oscar could be like a mirror to all the things who happened. A concave mirror, perhaps, yes.
A distorting mirror.
Yeah, grotesque pictures.
An email now from Bangladesh, from Fahana Titi. And this is what she would like to know. She writes, Dear Gunter Grass, I'd like to know about the background to your writing this book. Where did it come from?
Yeah, you see, just after the war, the opinion was in Germany, there was something dark in our history, who has happened to us, and terrible ghosts did lead us in the wrong direction. And my experience when I was a young boy was that all this happened on clear day. Yes, it was. You could see how the petite bourgeois families, how they followed this kind of propaganda of the Nazis. And I had the feeling I have to write something against this kind of mythologisieren, yes?
Mythology.
Like fate. It was not fate. It was a decision. A decision by the people. Hitler came to power by election.
This next question, Gunter Grass, comes from a BBC World Book Club listener in Auckland in New Zealand. He's called John Cranner. And he writes, The Tin Drum's my favourite book of all time, but what impresses me most is the utterly compelling and sinister voice of Little Oscar. How did you hit upon that precise tone of voice? And in retrospect, where do you think it came from?
This is his opposition voice, yes. He is against the things, and the only thing he really believes is his drum. And he has to defend his drum always, yes. And he has the drum and his voice.
I believe that when you're writing, you walk around trying out the sound of what you're writing. Did you do the same to get the tone of Oscar's voice? Did you try out various ways for him to speak?
Yes, during writing a book like The Tin Drum, I had forget about myself, yes. I was not lucky enough to stop my growing when I was 3 years old. I was in these years, I was really inside him, yes. And if you have fictional characters like Oscar and his grandmother and others, after some time, they have their own life. I remember that I was in the middle of the book. I was thinking about to give Oscar a sister. And he didn't want. He really protested.
I bet he did.
It was a time I couldn't write because he was against. And he was right. There was no place for a sister beside him. He was right, and I had to follow him. They have their own wishes, this fictional person. That means that the author is only the instrument to write things. Yes, yes.
I can absolutely imagine Oscar's fury if a baby sister had come along. He's not too pleased when he acquires what may be a baby brother, or may indeed be his son. The next question, Gunter Grass, comes from Zaya Ahmed, and this is from the University of Bahawalpur in Pakistan. And he rang his question in earlier, and this is it.
It's the British Empire, you explain. Yes, the lost British Empire is telling me story.
The dying days of the British Empire.
Hello, Mr. Grass. I am Zia Ahmed from Pakistan, and I am a PhD research scholar. I would like to ask you the following question. Why did you choose for this book to be about a tin drum? In other words, what is the symbolic significance of Oscar's tin drum? Many thanks indeed, Mr. Grass. Goodbye.
I wouldn't call it a symbol, yes. It's a toy, but it is also a kind of inspiration. It is an instrument for protest. It was an instrument of the Nazi ideology. It was full of drums around, yes, from the Hitler Youth up to the SR and all over. In all my childhood, I heard drums all over. Yeah.
Because when he's a child, one of the things he does is he climbs beneath the platform at a Nazi rally.
Yeah, yeah.
And when the drums, the marching rhythms are going on his drum, he's playing syncopated dance
rhythms.
He's
changing the march. This is a possibility of his drum. It's powerful.
There's a question from the UK from Frankie Rocket, who also wants to know about symbolism in the novel, and writes, if Oscar represents Germany under fascism, could you decode the symbolism of other major story elements? For instance, his scream. What does his scream mean? Thank you.
Very often this question's asking for symbols. I don't work with symbols. Yes, if I say potato, I mean potato. Yes, and it's very realistic. I write about this tin drum and the use of this tin drum. It's difficult for me to answer questions who are asking for symbols.
I was wondering earlier today, on the way here, I had lunch at a restaurant in Lübeck, and there was a child who was about three sitting close to me who was screaming. No windows broke, I wondered, in fact, whether some three-year-old child had partly inspired you to writing Oscar's Scream, because it is the most penetrating, attention-grabbing noise when a small child screams. Mm.
Yes, but also this has a background. They are in a closed-up room, the special temperature. A good singer can destroy glass. It is a realistic background. And I use this for Oscar, because he is an old boy who has defended his tin drum. He needs something to defend himself.
It's his weapon.
Yeah, he needs a weapon, and this is his weapon. And in his development, as he has a development, the only development he is as a development as an artist. First, he uses it only to defend himself, and then he is trying to make some artistic things with his tin drum. Later on, he can make money with his tin drum too, yes, what he's doing after the war.
And he uses his screaming as an art form eventually. He learns to break the windows. I think it's a theatre. Miles away across the town.
Then this was the first moment he discovered himself as an artist.
We have a question from the BBC World Book Club listener called Emilia Ippolito, an Italian. So not part of the British Empire. An Italian who picks up on the subject of Oscar Mazzarat using his drum as an artistic weapon, an artistic tool. She says, Oscar Mazzarat uses his drum and unusual voice to stop Nazi rallies, disturb Nazi activities, and also to escape from life-threatening situations. Is there a message to the readers about the potential strength and power of art, however uncommon and even crazy, against war, human stupidity and violence?
As far as literature can do something, many, many books like Tolstoy, Peace and War, War and Peace, this didn't stop any war. Yes, when I grew up as a young boy, I read Remarque. You see from the first line, he is able to see what is really going on with these young people. It was a killing, nothing else killing from both sides. And this was still impressing me on one hand, but in the meantime, because I did grow up in the Nazi time, I was influenced by the ideology. These books were not strong enough to change my mind about war. I still was believing up to the end of 45 that the Germans will win the war. Every reality was speaking against this, but I still was believing. You see, this is the discrepancy, the limited possibility of literature.
Well, an American listener to the BBC World Book Club, a professor of German called Tim Malcho, he emailed in to make that point, to say that, in fact, it seems to him that the novel is talking about the limitations of art, because he says at other times, I'm reading from the middle of his email, but at other times Oscar struggles with his inability to communicate his memories, especially in narrative form. At one point he tries in vain to describe a shade of red for which language has no word. And the novel even ends in sentence fragments after he laments having run out of words. He sees it very much as a statement about the limitations of what art can do. If young Oscar is an artist, a frustrated artist maybe, that's not all he is. He's also a sort of killer. He probably murders or at least helps to kill both his possible fathers. And it would be nice now to hear a reading. The war's ending, the Nazis are clearly going to lose, and into Danzig have come marching the Russians, the Ivans, including some Kalmuck soldiers. And they've broken their way into the cellar where Oscar is hiding with what's left of his family, which isn't very much of it, but still alive at this point is his one of his fathers, Matsarat. And what has happened as the Russian soldiers break in is that Matsarat has tried to get rid of his little Nazi pin because he thinks if the Russians find it on him, his fate is going to be even worse than it might be. And somehow, in the kerfuffle, Oscar has managed to get hold of it and has replaced it in Matsarat's hand.
Matsarat grew more and more terrified as he felt the party pin between his fingers. With my hands newly freed, I had no wish to witness what Matsarat did with it. Too distracted to pursue the louse, Oscar tried to concentrate again on the ants, but couldn't help seeing the quick movement of Matsarat's hand, and since he can no longer recall what he thought then, he says now it would have been wiser to keep the little coloured round thing in his closed hand. But he wanted to get rid of it, and in spite of his often tested imagination as cook and grocery store window dresser, could think of no other hiding place but his mouth. How important such a trifling gesture can be! From hand to mouth, it was enough to startle the two Ivans who had been sitting quietly on either side of Maria and send them leaping up from the air defense cot. They stood with their Tommy guns thrust at Matsarat's belly, and anyone could see that Matsarat was trying to swallow something. If only he had at least closed the party pin first with three fingers. Now he was choking on the sticky bonbon, turning red. His eyes bulged. He coughed, cried, laughed, and with all this turmoil of emotions was no longer able to keep his hands in the air. But the Ivans would have none of that. They shouted at him to show them his palms. But Matsarat was directing his entire attention to his respiratory system. He could no longer even cough properly, breaking instead into a little dance and flinging his arms about, sweeping a few tin cans full of Leipzig mixed vegetables from the shelf, all of which provoked my Kalmuck, who had been watching calmly up till then through narrowed eyes, to set me down carefully, reach behind him, bring something into the horizontal position and fire from the hip, emptying the whole magazine, firing before Matsarat could choke to death. The strange things one does when fate steps on the stage. Without thinking or noticing, while my presumptive father swallowed the party and died, I crushed a louse I just picked off the Kalmuck between my fingers.
That mixture of horror and humour is very typical of this novel. It's that constantly shivering on the edge of wanting to laugh and feeling, what? This is terrible. This is terrible. Is it fair to call it in some ways a comic novel?
You see, this chapter, there are many things happening in the meantime. Matsarat with his bomber, the Kalmuck with a machine gun, and the ants are marching.
The ants?
They're without any interest what human beings are doing. They have their own life and their own direction to the sugar. And this is very often in this novel. You see little happenings between this petite bourgeois and the proletarian peoples who are living their life in this time. In the meantime, there are battles in the Pacific between Japanese and Americans, and on the East Front, the Germans are winning or losing and going back, and it's always opening from this little world to what is going on around. Yes, this is very often in this novel.
Yes, because you can imagine a far more traditional approach would be to have everything focused on the shooting of Mazarrat, whereas this is much more fragmented, almost as though we're following Oscar's mind as it flits around and giving equal weight to things that aren't really equal. I mean, the shooting to death of somebody is not equal to an ant. Or maybe it is. Maybe that is exactly the point.
But this is a reality.
We were talking earlier about Oscar's particular voice, and to me it seems typical of him that he will call a bonbon, he will use the word bonbon or sweetie, for this pin that is in fact killing his father as it gets caught in his throat. And
yes, but you see, it is also, without using the word symbol, I say this, yes, it is also the behavior of the Germans just after the war. They tried to take it away, yes, to forget about, and there was nothing. After the war, we had so many anti-fascists in Germany that I was thinking about how it was possible that Hitler could be in power such a long time, you see. It is this kind of behavior. I take it away and it's away.
Okay, not a symbol then, but a very strong image, the idea of this thing. He's trying to swallow it, and it's absolutely ripping him up inside the further he tries to swallow it. Yeah. There are a lot of questions about fathers in the tin drum. I mean, apart from the fact that Oscar doesn't know for sure who his father is, and although he prefers to think that his mother's lover is his father, that we, the readers, don't know. Also, a bit later on, a child is born. Oscar wants to believe that he's the father of this child, but I think as a reader I tended to think it was actually Mazarrat who was the child's father. But there's...
He called both fathers, he calls mutmaßliche.
The putative father, is that the... Yes, So they exist as his father in kind of two parallel realities.
Now, nowadays, we have more possibilities to make clear who is the father. In this years, that was not so much not possible, yes?
Well, there was no DNA testing. No.
The assurance of the position of the father was much clearer than nowadays.
We have a question which comes from Osaka in Japan. It's from Ms. T. Horiguchi, and she asks this. Given the importance of fathers in your novel and Oscar's ambivalent feelings towards them, I wonder what your own father was like and what your relationship was like with your own father.
My father had blonde hair and blue eyes, and I'm dark and have brown eyes. And it's not the only difference between us, but I always trusted my mother when she said to me, this is your father.
I'm not sure that the question was particularly hoping to find out whether you thought your father was your actual father. I think they were more interested, as I read it, in the relationship between Oscar and his fathers, which is... on the one hand, very uninterested. He appears to be much more interested in his mother and his grandmother. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it's lethal. He kills them.
Then perhaps when he is coming back from the front, the Nazis wanted to take Oscar away and to kill him, yes? And the father says no. On one side, he hated him and he making his jokes about his father. But there are some moments where they are very close, yes? When he is really broken, when all his dreams, his little Nazi dreams, are broken down and everything is nearly defeated, then they are near together. Yes, it was with me too. This is like many boys here. You have some problems with your father. And when I became soldier, I was 16 years old, my father did bring me to the train station. And at this moment, we were very near together. Yes, perhaps he understood much more than I understood what was coming. Some days later, I was in uniform, and some months later, I was on the East Front. It was in Germany, and I saw that all these boys were killed in 5 minutes. But this moment on the rail station of Danzig, I remember quite well.
There's a question now from Katharina Hall from Swansea in Wales. And she's interested in Oscar's complicity in the death of, earlier in the novel, of his other possible father, Jan Bronski, his mother's Polish cousin and lover. And she asks this question. Dear Günter Grass, would you agree that Oscar can be seen both as a revealer of truth and a concealer of truth For example, he reveals the involvement of ordinary Germans in Nazi persecution and bears witness to its effects. But he also conceals his own rather dubious role in the death of Jan Bronski after the Nazi suppression of the Polish post office siege. Did you deliberately set out to make Oscar a morally complex individual? And if so, why? And before you answer that, I would like to stick in here because it's asking much the same question. It's a question that comes from Suad Sharabani, who's an Iraqi-born Canadian, and she asks a similar question, really. From the first page of the novel, I had the feeling of claustrophobia. You take us into the mind of a very, very sick person, an extremely disturbed, paranoid child man, and you don't let go. Why?
What, he is as sick as just the people of this time were, yes? He, as I said to you in the beginning, he is a mirror of his time.
And
Oscar is a broken person. It was not my idea to make the hero of a novel who knows everything well and has a straight moral position to all things who are happening.
Oddly enough, though, the fact that Oscar doesn't pretend he's a hero, that he in fact presents his disruption of church and Nazi party as a kind of aesthetic act. He doesn't like the symmetry, he doesn't like the balance. It makes him in a way, or made him for me, more attractive, because I could understand him better as this kind of frustrated rebel who wasn't acting out of idealistic concern at all, but out of a sort of generalised anger. I mean, he is not ultimately that unattractive a character, is he? Or do you think he is?
Yes, but he's cynical, but then he can also be moved when the death of his mother, or the death of Sigismund Markus. Yes, and there are moments in this book when he is really touched by things, when he's losing something, because Sigismund was a seller of his tin drums, yes? When the store is destroyed by the Nazis, he's stealing two of the tin drums because he knows quite well that there will come times who are very difficult for people like me, and I need the tin drum.
We have rain battering down overhead. We can't see it because there are these beautiful white lines under the glass ceiling, which I think are up there to protect us from the sunshine, should it ever come. But now it's rained. Does it rain often here?
In the last days, we had a very dry period before, and I'm very glad that's raining now because our garden they need rain.
Well, on the way into your house, I could see some of your garden, but I mean, it's just beautiful the way you've got all those hollyhocks and clematis growing up the front of this work shed, as you call it, which is a bit of an understatement.
It's growing through like in a fairy tale of Grimm.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Going to be taken over by plants eventually. Günter Grass, I notice on your bookshelf here a beautiful bronze eel that you've made. I'm picking it up now. It's a heavy thing curled round on itself.
That's one of my eels.
And it's ironic that this should be so very beautiful because there is a scene in The Tin Drum which is one of the most disgusting things I think many people have ever read. It concerns a moment when Oscar and his family come across a man who is fishing. He's got a bit of rope into the water and he's fishing something and he drags it out. And what he has been using as bait is the head of a dead horse. And as he pulls it out, eels are slopping and wriggling and falling all out of it. And the way you describe it, which is infinitely better than I've just done, and in infinitely more detail, is quite stomach-turning. And there is an English reader of The Tin Drum, a listener to the BBC World Service, Victoria Clark, who lives in Hampshire. And she has emailed this: Dear Günter Grass, just thinking about that scene with the eels still makes me feel ill. Since writing it, have you ever eaten eels?
But they are really tasty eels, yes. Everybody knows that eels are fishes who eat everything, yes. And also, if you have a dead horse head, they like it.
True, but you do know it's a disgusting scene because the whole thing precisely leads to Oscar's mother's death in that for a while she goes off eating anything because she just can't bear the memory of these eels crawling through the brains of this dead horse.
And then she eats herself to death.
So you knew it was a pretty vivid scene when you wrote it.
I was very astonished when the book came out and everybody spoke about eels. Yes, and for me it is one realistic scene like others. Yes.
Well, this bronze one is very beautiful, and I'm perfectly happy holding that. The tin drum is scattered with fragments of nursery rhymes, of children's verses, including one with which the novel ends: "The witch, black as pitch, the black wicked witch, ha ha ha." And we have a question from an English listener to the BBC World Service, Russell Barash, and here he is asking it about that.
Hello, Mr. Grass. This is Russell Barash calling from Hertfordshire in England, just outside London. I was very pleased to read The Tin Drum as a student at university, one of my favourite books at the time. And I remember specifically the childhood nursery rhyme, "Where's the Witch, Black as Pitch," playing an important part in the book. Can you tell us why you used this rhyme and what its significance is? Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Children like verses like this. Terrible verses, yes. It's only grown-up people who believe that we have to protect our children from these terrible things, and they clean up the grim fairy tales and other things. That's no help to the children. They like this, and Oscar is always surrounded by children, and terrible children. They force him to drink a terrible soup, and he has to defend himself. And I use very often in my novels this kind of telling a story like a fairy tale.
And you end this novel with the words of that rhyme.
Yeah.
So it has a particular significance.
Yes, because from Oscar's point on, the horror is not ended. It's still there and still there. There is no light on the end of the tunnel.
There's one English listener to the World Book Club who, like you, is both of Polish and German descent. And he wrote in to ask whether anything had been lost in translation from the original German text of The Tin Drum into other languages. And now we have all these new translations coming out. And I suppose the relevance of his question is more acute, because are the new translations being done because the original translations into English and all the other languages were in some way inadequate, do you think?
That's a feeling that some of these translations, they are well done, but they're a little bit Polish.
Polished.
Polish, yes. And, the language of the Tin Drum is much more direct.
Is it primarily to do with the language in itself, or is it because, I mean, the novel is full of very straightforward descriptions of sex and violence and so on and so
forth? This was one reason. The other was that I use some short sentences, but then also a long sentence. And Ralph Mannheim liked to cut this long periods in shorter sentences. And this is killing the rhythm of the language, yes?
Let's hear another reading now from The Tin Drum. This one takes place in 1938, November 1938, specifically, and this is when the murderous physical attacks against the Jews and their shops and their homes and their synagogues first broke out in what became known as Kristallnacht. And for Oscar, the most significant fact is that Sigismund Marcus, the man who sells him his drums, is Jewish and therefore is destroyed by this night.
Once upon a time, there was a toy merchant named Sigismund Marcus, and he sold, among other things, white and red lacquered tin drums. Oscar, mentioned above, was the major customer for these tin drums, for he was a drummer by trade, and neither could live without a drum, nor wished to. He hurried away from the burning synagogue to the Arsenal Arcade, for there dwelt the keeper of his drums. But he found him in a state that made it impossible for him ever to sell tin drums again in this world. The same ordnance specialists I, Oscar, thought I'd run away from had visited Marcus before I got there. had dipped a brush in paint and written the words Jewish swine across his shop window in Sutil inscript. Then, perhaps displeased with their own handwriting, had kicked in the window with the heels of their boots, so that the slur they had cast on Marcus could now only be guessed at. Disdaining the door, they had made their way into the shop through the window, and were now playing in their own deliberate way with the toys. I found them at play, as I, too, stepped into the shop through the window. They all looked like Maine, the musician, were wearing Maine's S.A. uniform, but Maine wasn't there, just as those who were there weren't somewhere else. One of them had drawn his dagger. He was slicing dolls open and seemed disappointed each time nothing but sawdust flowed forth from plump bodies and limbs. I was worried about my drums. They didn't like my drums. But Marcus had escaped their rage. When they wished to speak with him in his office, they didn't bother to knock at the door, but broke it down instead, although it wasn't locked. Behind his desk sat the toy merchant. He was wearing sleeve protectors, as usual, over his grey, everyday jacket. Dandruff on his shoulders revealed a scalp problem. A man with Punch and Judy dolls on his fingers poked him woodenly with Punch's grandmother. But Marcus was no longer in, could no longer be heard. Before him on the desktop stood a water glass that thirst must have urged him to empty at the very moment the splintering cry of a window in his shop turned his throat dry.
Well, Günter Grass, this reminder of what was happening in 1930s Germany was published at a time when Germany was trying to put all that behind it. And we have a question now from Gerardo González in Caracas in Venezuela, who asks this. Günter Grass, when the tin drum first came out in Germany, could you give us a sense of the reaction of German readers? Did it create controversy? And what were your feelings at that moment?
No, for me it was a surprise. The reaction was controversial from the beginning. People were shocked, and on one side, and on the other side, they liked to read the book, and it was in a short time what we call a bestseller. And also they tried to forbid the book, yes? They say it's pornographic, it's blasphemic, and so on and so on. It was going on also with the next book, with Cat and Mouse and Doggies. But then it changed. When now I make a big jump, a time jump, and we visited in Danzig the places where the tin drum happened. And we visited the church.
This is where Oscar creeps in and
destroys
the altar. He climbs on the statue of Jesus and tries to put drumsticks in his hands and so on.
With all the translators, he went in, and a young Polish priest, Catholic priest, stand behind us and smiled all the time. And after some time, he took from his satan the Polish edition of the tin drum and asked me to sign the book. I tell you the story because things have changed in 50 years, but in 59 the reaction was quite heavy.
Did that upset you?
No, not at all, no. I was sure about this book. And
we have a question here from a BBC World Book Club listener in the UK, Stuart Taberner, who wants to talk precisely about the appeal outside Germany of the tin drum.
Yeah, hello. Guten Tag, Herr Grass. My name is Stuart Taberner. I'm Professor of German Literature at the University of Leeds. I'm teaching a course on the tin drum from September, and I have a question which I know my students will be very keen to hear the answer to. And the question is, given that the tin drum is so rooted in its German context, so the war, Danzig, German guilt, and the post-war repression of the past, how do you explain its huge appeal to so many people in so many other countries? What makes the tin drum so universal? Thank you.
Well, Stuart Taberner is obviously a very devoted father. We could hear his baby crying in the background there. But essentially his question is, what does give the novel such universal appeal?
I was very astonished when I saw how the book was successful, first in France. In the East it was difficult, it was forbidden from the beginning.
In Eastern Europe?
Also in Spain. You know, it's also in Portugal. It was forbidden because it was
dictatorship.
Dictatorship, yeah. But in many countries in Scandinavia and in Poland, it was in the underground. Yes, they published several chapters because it was forbidden to get the book. I can't give a clear answer or the reason. Perhaps I describe this world of the petite bourgeois people. And this, as far as I know, the only international movement who's still in power.
Yes, and the petite bourgeoisie, the kind of shopkeepers of the world, let us say, aren't much written about, are they? Because the very poor are, and of course a great deal of literature recounts the doings of the rich and the highly educated and so on.
But perhaps it's also a reason that I'm belonging to this petite bourgeois people. Now we have in Germany many people who are coming from petite bourgeois people, but they like to react and to have the gestures and the behavior of upper class people. Yes, and, I make my jokes about it. There are many, many books and also good books who always blame these petite bourgeois people, because they are like this, they are. And I don't do this.
We have a question now that comes from Olga Bagaturova, who's in Dallas in the USA. And she wants to ask about the connection between the tin drum and your memoir, Peeling the Onion, in which you revealed that as a teenager you were briefly conscripted into the Waffen-SS. And here she is to ask it.
Hello, Mr. Grass. My name is Olga Bagaturova, and I'm calling from Dallas, Texas. I grew up in the Soviet Union and had an experience of a totalitarian country in some ways similar to yours in the 1930s. I would like to ask you to talk a little about the connection between the tin drum and peeling the onion, and how much the delayed growing up of the tin drum protagonist is explained by the repression of the memories that you eventually revealed in Peeling the Onion. Thank you very much, and it has been an honor speaking to you. Goodbye.
So how much is the delayed growing up of Oscar in the tin drum to do with your repression of memories that you then wrote about in Peeling the Onion?
Peeling the Onion is a book about my youth time, yes, and the finish is when I published The Tin Drum, and I was 30. But there are lines between my life and also The Tin Drum, and I describe growing up in Nazi time and following the ideology up to the end, and with this dark chapter when I was not volunteered to the Waffen-SS. They take me like thousands of young people in my age.
So you were conscripted into the Waffen-SS. I mean, you didn't have any choice about it.
No, I had no other choice. I was not volunteered to this Waffen-SS.
And you were 17?
I was 16 when I was trained in the Waffen-SS. I became 17, yeah. I really discovered the crime of the Waffen-SS after the war. And since then, it is a burden for me.
There's a question here from Klaus Moritz in New York in the USA, and he writes, Dear Herr Grass, why does Germany constantly reproach and debase itself concerning its recent history, when nations like Britain and the USA don't really give a damn about what they did internationally or internally in the past? Is morality greater in Germany?
I think that the self-understanding of Germans was up to Auschwitz, that we are a cultured nation. We have great thinkers and philosophy and all this and this, and very proud about this. And this is broken. And it belongs to our history. In the years after the war, understandable, people said, oh, no, let's finish this discussion about pastime. But it wasn't possible, because after a short time, the pastime was present. There was no other way up to now to be confronted to things who has happened. Also for me, when I discovered step by step, not in 1 minute, this crime, this without any dimension, And there is still no clear understanding how it could happen, how it was possible that educated people were able to give such power to a man like Hitler and to allow all the things. And it was not only the party and the followers of Hitler, also both churches, the Catholic Church, the Protestant Church, the bourgeois people, the industry, yes, the rich people, all they followed Hitler and helped him come to power. And also, we have to say, in the first years before the war, if I remember, 1936, the Olympic Games in Berlin, they came from all over the world. Yes, they came and admired how powerful Germany was. No more unemployed people and no danger of communism. That was one of the reasons of the West to trust Hitler in a way, to trust him. But also in England, we have to discuss. Sure, we begin in Germany to bomb Coventry and Rotterdam and Warsaw. That a city like Heilbronn, about 80,000 inhabitants in this time, was bombed in March 45. One third of the population were killed. It was terrible. Nobody speaks about this, yes? I think it was a crime. It was a crime to do it up to the end. There was no more reason to destroy these cities in the month of March or April when Germany was nearly defeated. I only speak about this because I'm asked about this, and the same question is to America. I still think that the atomic bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima was a war crime. And it was good to have this war crime tribunal in Nuremberg.
The trials of the Nazis. Yes,
the trial was all right, yes, but what we need is a war crime and perhaps to Mr. Bush in our days, but we don't have it. We don't have it. And this gives to people sometimes in Germany the feeling only the winners are able to make a war crime. And this is one part of the answer to this question.
One last question for you, Günter Grass. This comes from Marcus Eicher. He's in Berlin in Germany. He writes, "You will almost certainly be remembered most of all your work for the Tin Drum. How do you feel about that?"
I cannot change this. Perhaps for me, I like much more dog ears than the Tin Drum. But
you prefer dog ears?
Nobody's believing the author, yes. And for me, a book like The Flounder is as important as the Tin Drum. But people like to concentrate to one book, and they speak mostly about the Tin Drum. I can't change it.
No, he never could change it. And though it's madness to try and guess what literary history will eventually decide, I think it's likely that the Tin Drum will remain the work for which the German Nobel laureate is best remembered. That World Book Club interview with Günter Grass, who's died this week at the age of 87, was recorded in 2009 at his home near Lübeck, his final home, just as he wanted. And I should add that once the microphone was off, out came not just one, but a whole variety of bottles of schnapps. And many a glass was raised and drunk before the afternoon faded to evening.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.